my third little talk is probably the one of the three that reflects the kind of conversations Greg and I have been having for the last 20 years as media ecologists, people who've been influenced by Jacques Ellul and Walter Ong and Marshall McLuhan and Neil Postman, and then some of the more contemporary ones, constantly raising questions about human media. And so you note that I could title this either way, Paul and Ministerial Presence is one way I could title it. The other is Marshall McLuhan, the Apostle Paul, and Disincarnated Media. And so some of you listened to the Mars Hill audio with Ken Myers, and if so, you recall that when Ken Myers deals with issues of media, he's very intrigued by the fact that we celebrate the God who incarnated in his Son, and yet we live in a world of disincarnate media, and what kind of tension that creates for humans. So let me give you a little line from Marshall McLuhan, and then take it to ultimately to where I want to go with Paul's theology of ministerial presence. McLuhan says something that could sound insulting. He didn't intend it as such, and I'll try to explain it in a minute so that you see it isn't insulting. It sounds that way, though. I'm in the position, he said, of Louis Pasteur telling doctors that their greatest enemy was quite invisible and quite unrecognized by them. Our conventional response to all media, namely that it is how they are used that counts, is the numb stance of the technological idiot. Now, that sounds insulting, because we ordinarily use the word idiot in our day as a term of contempt. But McLuhan had enough classical training that I think he used it more etymologically. And you recall that idios in Greek merely means one's own. And an idiotes in Greek is merely someone who knows only his culture's own conventions or language. And so it means more that the person is parochial or unaware of how his culture has shaped him. It doesn't mean, as we think, a person that we regard with contempt. Paul used the term to the Corinthians. He said, "Otherwise, if you give thanks with your spirit, how can anyone in the position of an outsider say amen to your thanksgiving?" And what the English text translates as outsider there is tu idiotu in idiotes. So an outsider is a person who doesn't know your language or conventions. So when he says our conventional response to all media, namely that it is how they are used that counts, is the numb stance of the technological idiot, he means that's the stance of a person who grows up in a culture awash in media and therefore isn't aware of how consequential they are. It's the numb stance, you see, of a person who has been benumbed by an onslaught of media. And yet he regards that as normal and ordinary. That's his culture, and therefore it must be normal and ordinary. And so that it must be only how they're used that counts. See, that's how McLuhan is reasoning. And McLuhan recognizes, no, idiotes is not merely a term of contempt. It's a term to explain when a person is benumbed by his own culture and not aware that he has been benumbed by his own culture. And so in his concern, he says he's like Louis Pasteur, because when you first try to explain to people microorganisms were killing them, they would say, where? You know, they'd look, and they didn't see any microorganisms. And they said, there's thousands of them on your hand. And people go, oh, no, no, it's okay. It's okay for there to be thousands of them. Most of them are perfectly healthy. They're like the millions that are in your intestine that help you digest food. I've got millions in my intestine, right? So the initial generation, Pasteur, was overwhelmed by his allegation that they were literally crawling with micro-organic animals. It was a little creepy, right, to be told this. And McLuhan felt that he was in the same position, that there's something that profoundly influences human health that is invisible, and that most people hardly believe you when you tell them it's there, right? Felt like Louis Pasteur. And so he had said later, today in the electronic age of instant communication, I believe that our survival, and at the very least our comfort and happiness, is predicated on understanding the nature of our new environment, because unlike previous environmental changes, the electric media constitute a total and near instantaneous transformation of culture, values, and attitudes. He said that because electronic media do things that the other media hadn't done before. Manuscripts do not have alarms and do not make noise. A volume of Robert Frost's poetry doesn't alarm, and it doesn't make noise, so the printing press is a relatively quiet affair. But with the advent of radio and television and other ways of recording things, we now live in a world in which much of what we're exposed to is what I call unsolicited. You stop to get gasoline, and while you're putting gas in your car, you're listening to, I don't know, it might be Three Dog Night, but you didn't choose Three Dog Night, right? Whoever purchased the Muzak for that filling station decided it would be the station that plays Three Dog Night or whoever it is. And so we are constantly surrounded with unsolicited media, information, noise, and images. And McLuhan was the first to say that changes our environment. It used to be previously, if you wished to be disturbed by a Russian novel, you took it off the shelf, right, and you started reading it. And 125 pages into The Brothers Karamazov, you were good and disturbed, right? But if you didn't want to be good and disturbed, you could just leave it there. But now, if I pull in to get gas and 50 cents playing, I'm disturbed, and I can't turn it off, right? There's a speaker up there, and there's Curtis making money by selling his music to someone, and we can't do anything about it. As McLuhan once said, the good Lord gave us eyelids, but he did not give us earlids, right? And so there are things going on around there that he was encouraging us to be attentive to, and especially what happens with the electronic technologies, according to Ken Myers and others, how disincarnate they are. In my grandfather's generation, every human sentence you heard was attached to a human. Now, we would think it would be odd if someone heard the sound of a ghost, right? For my grandfather's generation, it would have been nearly as odd to have heard a human voice without a human being attached to it. And we see it all the time. The electronic media are characteristically disincarnated. They broadcast and send information across distances that we could not quickly travel. You can speak on a cell phone to someone in San Diego. But if you had to travel to San Diego to see them, it would take quite a while. 2 weeks before airlines, and still a good 5 or 6 hours ordinarily by airline. So I want to chat a little bit about this, the growth of disincarnated media, and how I think it's not a helpful thing, and surely not a helpful thing for ministers to take lying down. The disincarnated media permit us to interact with humans, I would suggest, in ways that would have previously been regarded as inhumane. I published an inconsequential essay in a book a year or so ago, a chapter in which several of us contributed. And I received an email 5-6 months after the book came out, I suppose, from someone who didn't introduce himself. His email signature didn't say Fred Farkle, Director of Technology Services at Toronto University. Nothing. Just Fred Farkle, whose name I didn't recognize. It wasn't Fred Farkle. I'm protecting the innocent. And it didn't say, you don't know me, but one of your former students is now my pastor, or something like that. No introduction at all. And it says, Mr. Gordon, I read your essay in this book. How can you say? And then off he went. No introduction, nothing. And so I didn't finish reading it. I didn't respond to that. That's what the delete button's for, if you didn't know that, by the way. That's what the delete button is for. If a communication begins rude, it should end right there, right? And so that's what the delete button is for. You just delete those and say, if the person never comes to his senses and tries again, we may give him a response. But this time he didn't merit one. And so he merited the delete button. But I thought, would a person who didn't like the essay, and as far as I know, it was entirely unlikable, but if a person didn't like it, had come to see me in my office, he would not have assumed that tone, would he? Right. Because I might have stood up and popped him, right? What kind of tone is that to use? Just go in there as a total stranger and say, how can you say X? Right? Well, I spent 20 pages trying to explain how and why I could say X. And if that didn't persuade him, an email wasn't going to do it either, right? But what kind of tone is that? How civil or uncivil is that? How humane or inhumane is it? And I think what happens in disincarnated media, they encourage an incivility because you don't have to run a risk of someone bopping you on the nose if you do it, right? And so when people say, I'm surprised at how uncivil some of the people who do televised news are, I say, I'm not surprised, it's on electrical media. That's what disincarnated media do. That we don't see the person in front of us as a bearer of God's image to be treated with dignity and respect as such. They're hiding behind a digital wall, as it were, and it promotes that. And so many cultural observers have expressed their concerns about disincarnated media. And I want to suggest that they were not the first to do it, that Paul was. And so I want to suggest to you what Paul said about disincarnated media. Paul, you know, wrote at least 14 or 15 letters because the First Corinthian letter refers to a previous correspondence. So, well, we've got a good number of them there. And we have every reason to believe he might have written some others that we don't know anything about. But he certainly wasn't afraid to write a letter. But nonetheless, letter writing was not his preferred medium. You and I encounter the Apostle Paul through the Holy Scriptures and his inscripturated letters. But the ancient church, for the most part, knew him face to face. So listen to what he says about his preferred medium in one of his letters. To the Thessalonians, he says, but since we were torn away from you, brothers, for a short time, in person but not in heart, we endeavored the more eagerly and with great desire to see you face to face, because we wanted to come to you, I, Paul, again and again. But Satan hindered us. His being torn away from the Thessalonians for a season, he regarded as Satan hindering him from what he wanted to do. He had to be satisfied to write them an apostolic letter. But what he wanted to do again and again was to be with them and to see them face to face. He said also to the Colossians, I want you to know how great a struggle I have for you and for those at Laodicea and for all who have not seen me face to face, that their hearts may be encouraged. For though I am absent in body, yet I am with you in spirit, rejoicing to see your good order and the firmness of your faith in Christ. Now, Paul was either the most vain of all first century people to think that it would be a real bargain to see him face to face, or he simply was recognizing the human nature of being human. And that the churches that he was forced to serve merely by letter, Colossae and Laodicea at this point, would have been better served had he been able to be there, present with them, face to face, as he said, in their very midst. He said similarly to the Romans, because he's on his way to Spain, Romans, or they're prominent, it's a prominent city, he wants to go to Rome at some point, he has to apologize in the first chapter for not yet having made it to Rome. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing, I mention you always in my prayers, asking that somehow by God's will, I may now at last succeed in coming to you. For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to strengthen you, that is, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. I want you to know, brothers, that I have often intended to come to you, but thus far have been prevented. So the Paul, whose letters are so precious to you and me, regarded them as substantially less precious than his own presence would have been, as substantially less effectual, as had he could have been present in those very churches and meeting with them. He was also aware that one can be misunderstood in such letters in a way that would not be the case as much personally. And so in his second Corinthian letter, he says, I do not want to appear to be frightening you with my letters, right? For they say, his letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak, and his speech of no account. Let such a person understand that what we say by letter when absent, we do when present. Note there also that he's aware that people can, they can sort of create someone in the manuscript culture that would be different if they knew him in private. This happens to me from time to time because I am a little impish, a little playful, and sometimes I'll say something in print that I thought was an attempt to be clever, and from a person who doesn't know me, it sounds very biting, sarcastic, and ill-intended, and it is, it's right. And so you realize that sometimes if you're personally present, if you smile when you say something, a person often takes it as a feeble attempt at humor. If you're not present, you haven't got a smile, right? No body language to clue a person as to your manner or your intention. It's just not there. But Paul is aware that to have been present with these churches would have been better for them and better for him. And he even thought in some of the difficult work of his ministry that personal presence was superior. As a student of Galatians and writing a book on it now, I've been fascinated for years with Galatians 2, of course, where Paul and Peter have their little tete-a-tete, right? And in fact, when I read Peter's letters, and he refers to Paul, our beloved brother Paul, and he says there are some things in his letters that are deus naitos, hard to understand, which the wicked and the unstable twist as they do the other scriptures to their own destruction. I think he's referring to Galatians 2, right? That the wicked and unstable are twisting to their own destruction. But here's what he says there. When Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. When I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the Gospels, I said to Cephas before them all in their own presence, if you, though a Jew, live as a Gentile, and so forth. And so note that Paul realized that certain things needed to be done in one's personal presence, and a letter was inadequate. And even when he wrote letters, he attempted to authenticate them as best he could by distinguishing the script of his amanuensis from his own script. And so at least five occasions, he said things analogous to what he says at the end of Galatians when he says, I write this greeting with my own hand, right? Or to the Philippians, it's the sign of genuineness in every letter I write. To the Galatians, he says, see with what large letters I write. Doesn't mean that he's shouting in bold face. It means that he's clumsy, right? He's not trained as an amanuensis, and he's not as skillful at etching into animal skin the letters of ancient Greek. And so he, in his clumsy manner, writes his own thing in there, and anyone looking at it would go, boy, that Paul might be a nice guy, but he's a klutz when it comes to writing, right? That they could see the difference in style between the measured handwriting of the amanuensis and the less elegant handwriting of Paul. And so Paul regarded writing as valuable and had good things to say about hygraphai, the scriptures, and hegraphe, the scripture, and in many occasions saying, it is written. So he had a very high regard for writing, unlike Socrates, who objected to it. But Paul also recognized that he would rather have been personally present with his churches, and he did not think that a letter would do it. Even when he writes the letters, he says, we want to be with you. And so he said something to the Thessalonians that I don't recall ever saying to any group I've ever attempted to serve in any way. But we were gentle among you, like a nursing mother taking care of her own children and being affectionately desirous of you. We were ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves, because you have become very dear to us. I don't know of many men who refer to themselves as nursing mothers to start with. It's an odd image, isn't it? But also, we share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves, or souls, as the text says, as though part of the communion of the gospel is giving themselves to these people who had become dear to them. And so as we wrestle with our moment and our information technologies, it's very important to recognize that that's probably a good term for them. They're pretty much useless at anything other than information, right? They're not humane technologies. They're not wisdom technologies. They're rarely understanding technologies. They're occasionally knowledge technologies. They're primarily information technologies. But what humans share with other humans is not merely information, but as Paul said, our own selves. And as Greg has reminded me many times through the years, it's not an accident that our English borrows from the same Latin root when the verb communicate or communication and communion come from the same root. That the language that we use, our abilities to speak and to write and so forth, are vehicles of human communion. They're the tools we use so that what's in one human heart or one human head can be shared with another human heart or another human head. And so the goal of our communication is communion. And information technology suggests, well, what we want to send to people is data, right? And there are moments when data is useful. It would be helpful this afternoon to be able to find my flight if it's written down somewhere. There it is. Yeah, I've got a flight and can get back to Western Pennsylvania. But nothing that's really consequential is merely information. Information is much less consequential than many things. And for Paul, what he wanted to share with the Thessalonians was, as he said, our own selves, our own souls, our own lives, because you have become, he said, precious to us. The presence of information technology and the amount of money that goes into it annually suggests that information is more important than it actually is. Right? Nicholas Carr, the former editor of the Harvard Business Review, the author of the 2008 Atlantic article, Is Google Making Us Stupid?, and then more recently, the book that came out last year, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. Nicholas Carr, when he wrestled with writings like this, he wrote a book called Does It Matter? And of course, it was big on the cover. Does IT matter? And as the former editor of the Harvard Business Review, he went to see over about a 10-year longitudinal study going from the pre-digital era to the digital era of doing business, how much it cost businesses to have IT departments. And then to raise the perfectly good question any businessman ought to raise, liabilities, assets, God, right? He determined that in most circumstances, most firms had lost more than they gained. In other words, the cost of IT compared to the amount percentage of its budget was not bringing in a corresponding income. He said, outside of the IT industry itself, it appears that everyone else is losing, right? That everyone else is losing. That a greater part of their corporate costs now go into IT than any corresponding benefit that they're getting from it. And yet it's such an enormous industry in our culture that if we think the economy recently collapsed, what would happen if that one collapsed, right? It'd be catastrophic for us. And yet the very presence of such an enormous industry must imply and suggest to us that information is very important. Because if not, our culture is spending an awful lot of money on what isn't, after all, very consequential. And so we live in an era in which these disincarnated information technologies now become a value challenge to the Christian church. They're challenging us to say, do we think human contact without a human attached is as valuable as human contact with a human attached? And does communicating information satisfy what humans do in life with one another? Because if we don't address the question, the culture's influences will steamroll us. We know where they would take us. It's perfectly evident that they would love us to have Facebook friends whom we've never seen, right? Which tempts you, if you're impish, you know, to just do your own fake Facebook page. It's the only self-control I've demonstrated in the last 4 or 5 years is not to do my own fake Facebook page, right? T. David's page, right? And of course, I'm going to have photographs that I upload. They will all be Shaquille O'Neal, but I'll call them myself, right? And, you know, you think of all the fun you could have, because with people who never knew you, how would they know that I'm not a 7-foot African-American, right? Right? There was the wonderful New Yorker cartoon of two dogs, right, seated next to each other on the floor, and one is apparently speaking to each other. The New Yorker's dogs, you know, are quite clever. Mine never spoke, but theirs do. One dog says to the other, on the Internet, nobody knows you're a dog. Right? and that's the way the Facebook is, right? That disincarnated humans can, in one sense, be whatever they want and whoever they want. And so my students, you know, they're like, in the 1940s, a person being the principal actor, the director, and producer in an old black and white movie, right? They can choose which self they want to present to the public. They can package that self however they want. They can contextualize it however they want. They're putting on a production, right? And they're producing an image that they want people to think is them, which permits a dimension or degree of inauthenticity that incarnated interactions simply would not permit. And so I want to suggest that Paul had it right 2,000 years before this, even when the only mediated thing between him and his people was a scroll, he still preferred to do them good by being present with them. He thought that that was actually important. That people should know not only information, but from whom they received it, and the character of those from whom they received it. Recall what he also said to Timothy, "As for you, continue in what you have learned and firmly believed, knowing from whom you learned it, and how from childhood you've been acquainted with the sacred writings, which are able to make you wise for salvation through Jesus Christ." He also said, "I am reminded of your sincere faith, a faith that dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and now I am sure dwells in you as well." Paul knew the relatives of Timothy, right? And knew from whom he'd learned the things that he'd learned. And so it seems to me that we should be much more attentive, deliberate, and wary of disincarnated media than our culture wants to be. That we should always ask how humane the medium is that we're using, and is there a more humane one for this particular purpose? Because they are in degrees, some of them more and some of them less humane. You may recall that in previous generations of the 19th century, ministers are sometimes called the parson, right? Which was a small derivative of person, because he was expected to be a human. And they wanted him and intended him to be, in some sense, an ideal person, to sort of, by his life, to show the rest of them what a person is. Even though they corrupted it and called it parson, they meant person. You couldn't be a parson if you were disincarnate, right? You couldn't have been a parson if you were disincarnate. You had to live with people, and they had to know you. And they had to see how you dealt with people who were rude to you, and maybe learn from that how to deal with people who were rude to them, right? And they watched you be gracious to someone, and they learned from that how to be gracious. You were the person that taught them what it meant to be a human. And so let me suggest a few things that ministers, I think, may want to think about, and their elders. Visitation is not merely problem solving. It's that by which we communicate ourselves also. In our pastoral visitation, at a minimum, we're saying, I am in some degree attentive to you. I am in some degree attentive to you. That I notice you, and your well-being is important to me. And it's more important than having a couple more extra hours free to watch a college basketball game tonight or whatever it might be. The mere presence of elders or pastors visiting their flock represents the Christ who took on human flesh for redemptive purposes. We also, in our bodies, take ourselves to be with people to see if we can assist them or aid them in some way, to encourage them, to instruct them, and at least to suggest by our presence that we notice and care about them. I also would recommend that, when possible, you use email for business matters, not personal matters, to try that for a while and see how it works. There are other media that are better suited to personal communication. And the value of email is, you know, you can send out a docket to a meeting as an attachment, and it goes to everybody all at once. It's very, very useful for all of those rather technical business-related realities of the administration of the church and her business, but it is not a very humane medium to use. And I recommend handwritten notes under a variety of circumstances. But in the 9 years that I pastored, my church was small enough that I could normally pray through the entire list of the families in the church each morning, because there just wasn't but 35 or 40 families at the peak. It was less than that. So it was such a small group to pray for that I had the privilege of praying through for the welfare of the church every morning. It's the thing I probably miss the most about the ministry. But I always kept my stationery nearby, and sometimes in my prayers, one individual or another, maybe two, I would, for some reason, just feel especially some concern to express a note. And so I just write them, "Dear Bob, just wanted you to know you were in my prayers this morning." And it was surprising sometimes how 8 or 9 months later, I'd be chatting with Bob, and he would say, "Dr. Gordon, I never told you this before, but when you wrote me that note, I was going through a very difficult time. I hadn't told you about it. I knew you were busy. And it meant a lot to me that I got that note saying you were thinking about me." And I think in a day where all of our communication is on the cheap and easy and quick and emailish and so forth, and we text and so forth, that especially now, ironically, a simple handwritten note, which is, this is pretty old technology, right? In fact, if it's a fountain pen, it's very old technology. It's not very new technology. But I think people especially appreciate a handwritten note. And I urge all ministers to keep stationery nearby when they pray, because you may sometimes feel, I think I just ought to make contact with this person also. You might also go visit them. I mean, there are hundreds of other ways of communicating. But I think that at least when you're writing in your own hand as opposed to a digital thing on a screen, it's more humane. And people who receive it as more humane, and they appreciate the effort that you've taken to do it. So I would encourage you to be parsons, to be humans, and to go ahead and accept the fact that we're not Gnostics and God gave us bodies, and that you set the tone for your congregation by your wariness regarding disincarnated communications and by your hearty proposing and encouraging of the more incarnated ones, and that you make it your effort to actually be with people so that they can see you and hear you and have the sense of your proximity. If you go back and read some of those Pauline passages that I read earlier, they're really quite striking. Paul, the great letter writer, confessing in those very letters their inadequacy and his preference to have been with them face to face. How many times do we dash off an email without any of a similar sorrow, right? As our culture trains us to be content with such disincarnation. Paul, much wiser, though living in a different era, and Paul much more wary of the limits of disincarnated media. So let me pause. This is the most curious, I suppose, of the three things we've chatted about, but oddly enough, for Greg and me, one of the ones that interests us the most.
How would you put phone conversations into things? You're talking about email. Less disincarnated than an email, put it on a spectrum?
Yeah, I think what you have to think about is this. There are certain people whose voice is almost like music to us. They're, I think, family who live out of state and at a distance. I think sometimes we especially want to hear their voice. The year that I was sick, Dad kept promising to come up from Virginia if I needed him, but he was too old then and too frail to travel that far. And so once a week, when the Percocet had kicked in to where I felt a little better than normal, I would call him. Because I think as my father, he just needed to hear his son's voice. It reassured him. And so I think there are circumstances where the fact that our voice is our voice a little bit, that the telephone can certainly be more humane than email. But I don't know that there's many people in our lives for whom that's true. I think for some reason, family, when they're at a distance, especially if they're at a distance when you're going through something difficult, it reassures them to actually hear the sound of your voice. And if you're self-conscious of it, you'll realize it might differ depending upon the individual you're having contact with. But frequently I'll get an email from a student with a question about whether they should do an internship this summer or go to grad school or something else. And my typical response is, my office hours are the following. Let's chat. Come on by and let's chat. And I try to interact with them. I have one of Stephen's students now who's an advisor of mine, and Mia comes by every now and then, and we chat a little bit and work on his plans and what he's going to do next year and that sort of a thing. And we can conduct more, I think, face-to-face than we can if I send him an email. He's going to farm oysters? Huh. Wait, growing up on the Chesapeake Bay, I know our oysters were fabulous back in those years. But, I'll have to have him bring me some in the fall when he returns. Well, I think I'm going to escape soon. And Gray, I don't know if you have instructions for their break time.